Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 146 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my live streaming career as a radio presenter with one big regret: never getting to interview my hero, the legendary singer, songwriter, and musician, Paul Weller.
Hey!
Now, this podcast, and indeed this live event that you'll hear more about in a second, exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul.
Hey!
And we are coming to you live from the Water Rats in London. These days, this iconic live music venue is a key pit stop on London's indie circuit. This place hosts just for anyone who's going somewhere. It's even seen live music from the likes of Bob Dylan, Oasis, The Pogues. It's hosted comedy legends, get ready for this, Smiler, Charlie Chaplin, Bob Hope, Lauren Hardy, and even Karl Marx is said to have stayed here.
Wow.
Not bad, right? Now, look, this is not a bad place to bring this podcast to you live from here this afternoon. For this live episode, I am joined by Paul Smiler Anderson. This fella is so used to being on stage playing music, usually behind the decks as a DJ. His musical tastes are so on point that Paul Weller and his band have played his mixtapes in the dressing room before live shows, right?
That's true.
Nice. He's also an author, and we'll go through his incredible books, right? He is known for creating the defining work on the world of mod. This thing is the Bible, all right, if you're into modernism.
Supposedly.
Yeah, if you're into that cult. We'll talk more about that in a sec. And Paul Weller was such a fan of this thing that not only did he recommend it to all his mates, he insisted that he meet up with Smiler. He featured in the follow-up book as well, and we'll talk about that. And Mr. Weller came up with the idea for Smiler's latest book as well. So some pretty cool links that we're going to dig into here. Smiler's written fanzines. He's written record sleeve notes. He's presented radio shows. How the heck we're going to have time to fill this in, I do not know. But we're giving it a good go. Please welcome Paul Smiler Anderson.
Bless ya!
Now, we've had a few people with nicknames on the show, right? Some of them given to... Paul's given them the nicknames. So, like, Brother Shees from Stone Foundation, for instance. Yep. The General from Stone Foundation. Tufty, who's here? Oi, oi!
He's there.
Is he still here, or did he...
Yeah, he's there,
There he is. But we've had all kinds of people with great nicknames. So, tell me... Well, two questions, right? What's the nickname Smiler? Where does that come from? And the second question, really importantly, is it a clean story that we can tell?
Yes, it is. When I was a kid, I was about 13, 14. I was working at Lipton's as a shelf filler. This girl that I really fancy, who was probably about 18, went, "Oh, you're a proper Smiler, aren't you?" So it didn't get me anywhere with her, obviously. But I got home and my dad said, that was my nickname as a kid. I was like, that's it. So as a DJ, all these people call DJ Embark or DJ whatever they were called. I went, I just called Smiler. And that was it. So I've been known Smiler ever since.
I love that. You didn't know that your old man had that thing.
No, didn't know. And they went, that's it. Because you smile for a genuine reason. I think, thank God I'm alive. See, that was positive. I said, thank God. So you know.
Oh, you can swear, but you know, we'll have to.
Okay, I'll say, thank fuck I'm alive. And I'm alive. So I thought, yeah, Smiler, yeah, That's good.
It's
a good name.
Hey, look, so let's kick off. What came first, the jam or mod? In your world, what came first?
Probably the jam. It was something I didn't know I was looking for. I was too young for punk. I love punk. And my uncle said to me, there's these two people called Johnny Rotten and Sid Vicious. And I thought he was joking, winding me up. I went, yeah, okay, yeah. He went, no, really? And I thought, well, that's it. And they went, they're terrible. So, of course, I had to listen to it. And Pretty Vacant came on Top of the Pop. So I was like, wow, great. But I was 12 at the time, probably. And so 14, 79, I'm the right age. And I'm hearing all this stuff about mods. And I become a mod.
Take me back to the time. Was Paul actively talking about mod and being a mod and that? Did that come through the jam interviews and conversations? Or was it something you found outside of that? It just so happened it coincided with the jam.
I'll be honest. I can't really remember. It was so, yeah, I was 14. There was so many things coming in at me at the time. All I remember is like hated what I liked. Yeah, like my sister hated it. She was into like White Snake and like heavy metal. But I did steal her Who greatest hits with the exploding jukebox. So I stole that from her thing and she was like, where's that gone? I was like, that's what I like. And I really got into the Who. And I think it was an extension of that, really. I don't really remember a lot about it, but it was just like all the kids at school were like, you were either one thing or the other. And there was a mod crowd and I was drawn to them.
And from a jam point of view, so at that point we've had everything up to and including all mod cons, I would guess, 79, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So you've got Setting Sun, Sound Effects, all those singles to come.
Yeah.
Did they then become like your band? So 14 years, so many people have talked on the podcast about being that schoolboy age.
Yeah, I've always felt fraudulent because I never got to see the jam live. Yeah, I was 17 when they split up and from Reading, and all the people I knew loved the jam. And I was like, wow, that's great, you know, brilliant. But we're all so young and living in Reading, London seemed another place. It was, so I'd go see gigs around Reading and stuff. It was a horrible thing, you know. It almost guts me these days that I never actually got to see the jam. So I feel fraudulent in a way, which I do.
Well, it's going to be a very short conversation because I thought that's what we were talking about. But so talk to me about mod then, because my understanding is it means different things to different people. And I was reading an interview with Paul the other day where he was talking about, well, so some people, and Stu, if he's still here, talked about the Holy Trinity of like, you know, the things being clothes, music and football. But actually then Paul talks about it's more than a trinity. There's a fourth, which I can't mention, but he talks about clothes, music and girls. And something else. What was yours?
Records and clothes.
Those two.
Totally, yeah. And clubs. Yeah, clubs. Ah. And bands, you know, like it was always, I had this whole thing at 14 that I got clothes obsessed, totally clothes obsessed, but I was totally into records and that's it. I started building my record collection up and I got into 9 Below 0, who were an R&B band. And then I worked out that they said, oh, we like John Lee Hooker and Muddy Waters. I was like, who are these people? So I started collecting that. And it was really weird because at the time, Reading, there was a guy called Mark Bicknell, who was a very well-known Northern Soul DJ these days. He's playing Northern Soul to people, and I didn't get it at all because I was into Muddy Waters and John Lee Hooker and Jimmy Reed and stuff. So I started collecting these records. And in 85, that's when I finally pushed myself onto the Reading scene, sadly. Sorry about that. And I become a DJ.
There was like a mass exodus from Reading at that time.
It was mental because people actually came along and went, wow, don't know any of this. And it was brilliant.
These days, to be a mod and to start, it's like an expensive hobby, right? Record collecting is expensive. Yeah. Clothes, the clobber that you're wearing, yeah. You know, it's not cheap to be a mod, right?
No.
Was it like that back in the day as well?
I don't know.
More affordable?
I've chatted to Paul about this, funny enough, and I was saying that I'm a working class, I'm still a postman, I've been a postman for 40 years. So when I was 17... I was a postman and God knows how I did it, but somehow I ran a scooter, I had clothes and I had records and I went out and it was all, and I paid my mum and dad keep. I can't work out how I did it. Even now, I don't know how I did it. It was totally working class thing. It was always, you know, there was, don't get me wrong, there was always records I wanted, clothes I wanted, out of Gloss. And even now that happens. And it's what I'm used to in life, I guess, that I always want that hunger. But no, it was a totally working class thing.
And where was the inspiration coming from for the music? Because some of these are like not necessarily, they're not chart topping acts that you're talking about, like that's older stuff, but you've always been to like the really obscure stuff, this, you know, playing songs that people might not know and all that kind of stuff too.
What happened there was I was collecting this stuff that I'd heard Nine Below Zero said about Little Walter and Jimmy Reed and stuff like that. And then one day we were down a pub. We had a pub in Reading called the Boar's Head, which is sort of mod friendly, and otherwise else you'd probably get beaten up. So we went there. One day I said, do you know what? I wouldn't mind going to London. And one friend, Richard Molyneux, went, I'll come. And in 1984, I think it's March 84, we set off to a club called The Phoenix, and I walked down and they were playing Slim Harpo, and I realised that, wow, there's a whole other thing that exists outside Reading. And after that, we were in London every single weekend, and I totally embraced it, and I started collecting records even more because I heard more and more records that Paul Hallam and Richard Early and Don Bassett were playing. Right. So I collected records totally off that.
Okay, let's rewind a little bit back to the Jam as well. So Paul, obviously, you know, his look and his style presumably is an influence as well.
Totally.
Talk to me about what you loved about, let's talk about the Paul Weller, the look of it, and then we'll talk about the music.
Okay, well, you know, I mean, it was weird because I can remember at the time at school really seeing a person with a haircut, and it was just everything. It was a whole image thing, and being, I guess, seduced is the word. And seduced by that, and not knowing it was to do with mods or anything, and thinking, wow, that's cool, that's cool, that's cool. And eventually you realise there is this mod thing going on, but I didn't know it. And so I was going to school looking, I guess, like a mod, but not knowing I was a mod. Mm. And then the mod revival is... But I said I didn't become a mod till September 79, which is quite late in the scheme of things, because a lot of... people were mods before him. But in Reading, that was, I guess, the button when I thought, yeah, I'm a mod. And my sister didn't get it because my sister was into Whitesnake and like quite heavy metal. And she's like, what are you doing? And and I was totally not influenced by my sister or anything. It was a totally individual thing. I felt it was like my, what I wanted to do.
You discovered something that was for you.
Yeah.
It just happened there were quite a lot of other people.
Totally. Yeah, totally. But I realised that's, and it's never gone away ever.
Let's talk about the music. So what was it you loved about the Jam's music? What songs stood out for you?
Eaton Rifles, A-Bomb in Waller Street. Well, blimey, there's so many. I'm trying to think of how many there were. But Strange Town was really big. I can remember walking around my paperboy round with a little tape recorder, and they were the proper little thick, you know, like, tape recorders, not like they are now, little portable tape recorder with paws and stuff. Yeah, and I recorded off the top 40 on the Sunday, which, you know, you always had the top 40 on the Sunday. And I can remember walking around Strange Town playing all around my like paper round. So, yeah, totally.
How did you feel when it all came to an end? Sorry to mention this, Shane, in the room.
Oh, that was a quick jump, wasn't it? Well, it felt like the end. I'm sure that there are other Jam fans, but it was almost like the abyss. I don't know where we go. I don't know. It's gone. And yeah, who knew what would happen? But it did feel like that's our band. And he says, we're gone. I can't explain it. It was it. There was nothing else. Yeah, I like the Purple Hearts, I like the Secret Affair. I like the Lambrettas. All that had happened by then. But when he said that, it was like, oh, I don't know. I don't know where life goes off. It was, for a kid that age, it was a bit. I've heard of people saying they ripped down all their posters of their walls and stuff. Yeah. I never had that. You know, I didn't have that moment of ripping down posters off walls. But I can remember thinking it's gone, and it was almost like a life end, which is weird. It wasn't. So thankfully.
Well, there was a lot more to come, and we're going to dig into a lot of those memories as well. But I think the thing that's really interesting, as we talk through the books that we'll talk about your books and your publications. We'll dig into Memories of the Jam and the Style Council and Weller Solo as well, because it's all connected. And let's talk about this first one. So this is Mods, the New Religion. I don't know how many in the room have got this incredible. I was saying to you before we started, so many of these amazing coffee books come out, and I'm kind of almost scared to look at them. Do you know what I mean? You don't want to get them dirty. I don't want the kids anywhere near this. So you kind of, you're like almost like reading them with snooker referee umpire gloves that you don't want to touch them. This is such a stunning book. And I guess when you talk about mod, it's all about detail.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what, like 5 years of your life, plus everything in your head from before that, but all the research. This is a proper labor of love, this, yeah?
What happened was I'd written fanzines. And I'd always wanted to write a book about mods. So I thought I'd write a book about mods in the 80s, which is when I was a mod. You know, and I thought I'd felt quite enough that I'd been involved enough and DJed in the 80s and stuff. And then a guy called Manny wrote a book. I don't know if you've seen it. There's a book written about it. So I gave him all my 80s mod stuff. And I gave him all my leaflets and flyers because it was all you'd been written. So what's the point of me writing it? So I was like, oh, okay, that's gone. And I thought, sod that, I'm going to write a book about the 60s, which I loved, and the most uber critical people you could ever write about in the world. But I spoke to Jeff Dexter, original 60s mod, and he was like, yeah, okay. So we chatted for about an hour on the phone, and he went, you seem to know your stuff, Smiler. I went, great. And he went, I'll think about it. Put the phone down. And then after that, I got Steve Ellis. I got Lloyd Johnson. I got various other people, quite big players involved. And then Jeff rang me up one day and went, Paul, I've heard you've done your homework. I'm in.
Nice.
And after that, it was fine. It was great. And then I got Martha Reeves and Eddie Floyd. And what I wanted it to be was that book had to be about the mods and the people they worshipped, which were people like, you know, Eddie Floyd and stuff. And if I couldn't get people like Sonny Boy Williamson and Jimmy Reed, like all the blues, I had to get people who knew them. Mm-hmm. So that's what I did in that book.
And you also talk about this subculture exploding in London, but actually proliferating around the UK.
Yeah, that was really important to me because I realised coming from Reading, I mean, I don't know, I'm sure if any of you from London, you'll go, Smiles from Reading. I went to the gate and they said that it was shut, you know, like, and so it was always like about it being very small. And I thought that's not really fair because I went for all that. And so it had to be about it being a broad thing. Whether a bloke was a mod in, I don't know, Cirencester on his own, but he was a mod, he was the only mod in Cirencester, I want it to be his story. And so it became a big thing. I was going off to Manchester and Portsmouth and wherever, Birmingham and wherever. It had to be about mods from everywhere. Because all the things have been written either were like London, which were mods, or Northern Soul, which was like 70s, like Wigan and wherever. Nothing had ever been written about mods from all over. And that's what that book attempted to do and hopefully did.
Well, it's an amazing publication because you really dig into the roots of it and everything.
Yeah.
But it gets such amazing feedback when it goes live. What to the point that Mr. Weller hears about it. So how does this come about? How do you get news that Paul's into the book and likes the book?
Well, me and Mark Baxter have been friends for a long, long time. So me and Mark Baxter have been good. So I think Bax had obviously said, Smile has done this. So 2009, I did my a museum exhibition, which was the biggest museum exhibition ever on 60s mods that me and my friend Damien Jones did. Loads of people turned up, Eddie Piller and Terry Rawlings and Mark Baxter and quite a lot of people turn up and Chris Farlow and goodness knows what. And it's really the museum's most successful ever exhibition to this day. So we do it and it's totally about 60s mods. We get original flyers, original posters, original clothing. The jukebox is from the Birdcage Club in Portsmouth, the original mod club in the 60s. We deck out in all total records, free play, so people can walk around an exhibition and choose whatever record they want, whether it be Green Onions or, In the Midnight Hour. But it's totally what would have been on in that jukebox in the Birdcage in the 60s. And so it's great and really good. And Paul didn't know me at the time. And so Bax going, no, you've got to go around and smile and sing. It didn't happen. So it was fine. It didn't happen. And I was a bit gutted, but it didn't happen. A bit like you, that search.
Yeah, what, we're on 140 something? Yeah, it'll happen.
And so what happened is I write this book, and it was meant to coincide with the book. I couldn't do an exhibition and a book. It was too much. So the book finally comes out. Don't know how this happens. I'm sorry, I'm going to swear again now, so you can edit out, but fuck knows how this happens. Everybody hated us, and it ends up, somebody rings me up and says, Paul, do you know your book's in the Sunday Times top 10 best-selling books this month? I'm like, shut up, you tart. He's going, no, it really is, Paul. And he sends me a thing. So I end up running down to Waitrose on this Sunday day, and there's one copy of the Sunday Times. There's one copy left, and I pick it up, and my God, we are in the top 10. I never thought I'd ever see it. So I think, oh, this is doing all right. Next thing, Mark Baxter rings me up and says, Paul Weller's got your book. I've given him a copy. I'm sure you've met Mark. Hello. He goes, hello. Smiler. He's got your book. He wants to meet you. So we do it, and bless, sorry, Mark, if you think that's a bad.
That's very good.
If you ever hear it, he goes, right, my son, right. So he goes, oh, he wants to meet you. So bloody hell, I start thinking, oh, what am I going to wear? So done the whole thing, right, of going through what I'm going to wear. So I get a handmade shirt that I had, like a button down, handmade stuff, so start on it. And my wife's going, are you sure you're meeting a bloke? Still, I am. Yeah, definitely. You sure? So my wife had doubts. But anyway, I met him, and it was brilliant. And I can tell you now that apparently the go-for thing when you meet a mod is Paul Weller walked in and went, Smiler, love your book, and gave me a German copy of Tin Soldier by the Small Faces.
Well, I slips it into the handshake. Went,
there you go. Have that. And it was like, wow.
Wow. He didn't need to do that.
No, he didn't. And it was really lovely. And
is that a standard mod handshake?
I don't know. That was the whole thing. It set the precedent of like, wow. And I was really enamoured.
What did you have? You had stuff for him as well, presumably, right?
I did. Yeah, I gave him a copy of my Fleur-de-Lis book that I'd written beforehand. And he hadn't got that. And he went, oh, I've heard about this. And it was really nice, yeah. And I've got to tell you now that the one thing he did say, he'd just come from the gym. He looked really fit. He doesn't drink anymore, Paul. The one thing he said, you've got to know, he said, I'd hate to die on a treadmill. He said, no rock star should die on a treadmill. He said, if you're going to die, you die like John Entwistle in America at your head. I'm like, that's fair enough.
And I heard that you gave him like a mixtape as well. Was that that? Was
I've
that
given
time?
You. I've done that, but I don't know how that came about. I don't know how he got the mixtapes, but he got my mixtapes. And then Andy Lewis sent me a message one day and went, "We're in Ireland, and Paul's insisted that we listen to your tapes." Oh, because I thought I'd given these tapes. I thought he's not going to listen to them. He's insisted we listen. He said, "And we're all dancing around." Thing waiting to go on. I said to my wife, I went, bloody hell, how's that happened? I said, all these years, all them years, I've gone to see Weller, listen to it, and now he's listening to me.
That's mad, isn't it? Yeah, well done.
Never thought it happened.
I mean, it's mad when you think of that 14-year-old kid into the, you know, discovering the jam, all things mod and all that.
Yeah.
And then here we are off the back of the book.
Yeah.
You're meeting, I mean, your hero, really.
Totally, totally. In awe. I'm privileged. And I said, I never thought it would have come to that then. And I can remember the day that I was on holiday. I was in Devon, and Mark Baxter said, Paul Weller wants to send you his phone number. And I was like, great. So the next thing, bang, it comes. I was like, fuck, I've got Paul Weller's phone number. It was like the golden, it was like Willy Wonka and the golden ticket. What happened was I got another text from Mark Baxter saying he wants to talk to you at a certain time. Can you do it? I was like, yeah, of course I'll do it. It landed on the day I got my son christened. My wife's from Oxfordshire. So I was like, okay, so it's not bad. And he went, I think it was like 7 o'clock at night. I think he said, oh, I thought that's easy. I'd do that. It's like the christening's at 2 o'clock or whatever. Easy, get back. We're coming back late than I thought. And my son goes, Dad, I need a poo. Can you pull over? So pull over. I'm looking at the watch going to Lorraine, like my wife, going, oh, it's getting a bit down. We go about another, I don't know, 20 minutes down the line. Dad, I need a wee. I'm like, you are joking.
Well, it's going to
ring. It was like, and I got back as the phone rang. I walked in as the phone was ringing, and then I spent an hour chatting to Paul. This before we really met properly. So I'd met him before. I literally met him, but it felt like almost like I had to pass the exam, which I'd accept any day because he was like, yeah, what do you think of this new band and what do you think of that? And it was lovely. And it was about an hour and a half of us just chatting about music and what we thought of things and what your thought on this, on politics and stuff. And it did feel like I was having to get the right answers, but I did pass. And it was good. And he was like, oh, yeah, okay. And next thing, yeah, backtrack. All right, Smiler, you're in.
You're in.
And it was lovely. I'm not knocking it. It's sort of making it a thing, but it did feel that way. It was like Paul had rang me up and asked me, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? And it was lovely. And I'm glad that he liked my answers. So yeah. I feel privileged that he liked what I said.
I don't know if I'm enjoying this or this making me more anxious about that if the interview ever comes.
Oh, it's great. He's...
Well, I passed the test.
Oh, he's lovely. I always stick up for him. Yeah, when people knock him who don't know him, he's so funny. I'd sit there thinking, I'm laughing all the time when I'm with him.
Now, look, one thing is pissing me off in the fact that Baxter was guest number two on the podcast like 2 years ago. Come on, Bax, bloody hell. All right, look, I want to ask you about, there's so much to talk about, Christ. Let's talk about Mod Art. So this beauty is the follow-up.
Yeah.
And a different approach. Obviously, we're not digging into the historic aspects of the culture, the subculture, I don't know what you call it.
Yeah.
Right? But we're talking about all the influence that Mod has over art.
Yeah.
And this was not necessarily a topic that you knew loads about, so probably even more research on this.
No,
right?
It was, in truth, I went to Omnibus. And once they realised that the New Religion, bear in mind they'd refused the New Religion to begin with, and I had to spend 3.5 hours going through my photographs with Omnibus. And I'm not knocking them because there were a couple of people there who actually believed in me totally after what I'd sent them. But they were like, oh, we've already got books about Mods. You know, that's it. Terry Rawlings' book had come out. And it could cannibalise our own books. I went, my book looks nothing like it. So when Mod the New Religion, they were like, wow. I thought, oh, I'm going to look like One Trick Pony here. And I thought, ooh, I'm a writer. Which I'm not. I'm obviously a postman or whatever, just pretending to be a writer, thinking I, you know, aspirations above my station. But I thought, oh, you know, I'm going to try and prove that I'm a writer now. I'm like, ooh, I'm a writer. At the time, I had every copy of Town Magazine. And Town Magazine, obviously, which was Man About Town and Town, had done the first ever thing about Mark Bolan and Mods and stuff. And my friend Damien Jones had given me every single issue of Town Magazine in the 60s, which ran from, I think, 58 to, I think, 72, I think it is, roughly. So they give me every copy. And I was like, wow, this is great. You know, like, I'll write a book about Town. So I go to Omnibus. I went, I want to write a book about Town Magazine. And they went, oh, there's a lot of hassle because of
the rights and stuff.
Yeah. How about, Paul, you just write Mod Art? Because we've got punk art and gothic art, and you're the person to write Mod Art. And I was like, oh, so I'm a one-trick pony straight away. So I said, what about if I write it in the way I want to write it? So it has to be about pop art, and it's not just like, obvious. It has to be about pop art and rare fanzines and rare magazines. And I got off an interview, Paul Weller and original revival Mods and stuff. They went, do whatever you want. But it was nice because Paul and Mick both got involved. Paul Weller and Mick Talbot both got involved in that.
Yeah, so I was going to say, obviously, at this point, then, you know, not only has Paul been recommending the first book to everybody that comes along and in magazines and things like that, you've obviously met. So in this book, and we won't just talk about Weller, there's other aspects to that. It's not a Paul Weller book, but there are three kind of elements with Weller in where we talk about the Jam, talk about the Star Council, and we talk about Weller solo. So I thought it'd be fun to dig into those conversations and to those memories. So I'm going to start backwards. Well, I'm going to start in the middle with the Style Council, because presumably this was your band.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
I mean, where does it figure in? That, I mean, they were all about fashion as much as the music, weren't they? So the mod thing that you talk about, those two things you loved,
yeah,
fits perfectly.
But the thing that people have to realise is there's a difference between mod and modernism. So I call myself a mod, but also there's modernism, which is what Paul's totally into. Paul's always moving forward. And I didn't suss that probably till the late 80s when acid jazz came along, and then Eddie Piller, and there was a lot of mod friends doing stuff that I thought, oh, it's about moving forward. It's not about, you know, this retro. I lived in this world of, you know, like I thought I lived in 1963.
Okay,
in the
80s. So it was all about like vintage almost.
Yeah, yeah, totally, right. Totally. So I ran vintage clubs and wore tailor-made clothes, and I suddenly realised that there was a whole world about modernism, about embracing what the latest thing is, whether it be rap or whatever, which is what Paul Weller was doing. And I actually sussed it then. I thought, God, this is what it's about. I'm not an idiot. You know, I've moved forward. So with the book, I tried to get the mod art book to encompass everything. So when I chatted to Paul about it, he mentions the Style Council days. He mentions Beyond the Style Council days. Mick Talbot mentions Beyond the Style. Yeah, Mick is, I know you've met Mick, who has got the most photographic brain in the world and can remember everything, can't he? He's amazing, isn't he? So it's a great thing. And I could suddenly see why Paul got involved with him, totally. He actually encompasses everything about mod.
So the three albums that you dig into are All Mod Cons a Jam.
Yeah.
Our Favourite Shop, The Style Council.
Yeah.
And Stanley Road, Paul Weller Solo.
Yeah.
And all three have this, I guess, it's pop art, but this kind of collage connection.
Which I hadn't sussed ever. Did you? I never thought of that until I started writing the book. And then I realised that all of them, I mean, Paul is really anti, you know, retro. He doesn't think back to the old days or anything. But what is really strange, it was his idea in all of them situations, whether it be Our Favourite Shop and All More Cons and Stanley Road, are all collages of his influences. So it's very strange, really, because he's a very anti, but a lot of them include retro things that his influences are. And I realised that. And it was great. And I think Our Favourite Shop is the biggest insight into both him and Mick Talbot's psyche at the time.
It's great in the book because you dig into, you know, why they're picking some of those things and choosing those, yeah, those items. As a fan of that music, when you get the album sleeve, that's what you're doing. You're pouring, yes, you're looking at the front totally cover, but actually you're pouring through the inside sleeve of All Mod Cons and trying to then dig out the things, or you're looking through the shop of Our Favourite Shop, yeah, and trying to work out what it is and where you can get it and all that, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. When All Mod Cons came out, I mean, how many mods knew who the creation were? And Paul was there giving you that, the creation. You're like, wow, who are the creation? And you found out who the creation were. And then years later, obviously, The Action. Yeah, he wrote the sleeve notes, The Action stuff. I never heard The Action in my life. I was like, oh, sleeve notes by Paul Weller. I'll buy that. Yeah, and he did. Bloody hell, he's influenced a lot of stuff, you know, to me.
You talked about fanzines, and I know you've been involved in writing for fanzines, writing fanzines, yeah, and stuff.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
And Eddie Piller's been on the podcast and talks about his, which is a fascinating story. But in the book, there's Paul's December Child is featured, and there's an image of,
yeah,
of that, which ran to, what, 3 copies, I think?
Yeah. he wrote his original pop art poem, didn't he,
in that thing. But yeah, so you're digging into all those kind of connections, all those memories and stories as well.
Yeah.
What was it that was so important about fanzines at that time?
I think fanzines were important because nobody else was interested. I mean, God, you know, mods were belittled in NME and Sound. I mean, Sounds were probably better for us, but the NME and Melody Maker surely didn't care about mods. It was it was ran by people who were, you know, still listening to probably Jethro Tull and maybe Status Quo or whatever. And they had no interest in this whole lot. And if they'd seen mods, they'd seen it all before. You know, we've seen mods before. It's been done, been gone. There was no thing about revival, even though they seem to embrace two-tone, they seem to embrace rockabilly. There was all that stuff going on. But mods, I don't know why, we always had a hard deal. And I haven't forgotten that, you know, even now, that all them years ago, everybody said that I know hated mods. When I said to Paul, we chatted to Paul on an Eddie Pillar radio show once, and I said to him, everybody hated mods. And well, it was like, really? I don't know whether he was distant from it, but they did. Everybody hated mods, and it was a really hard thing. And now it's all, oh, yeah, you know, Britpop and scooters, and everybody loves mods. And it's like Salt and Vinegar and Brighton and Quadrophenia Alley, and it's all acceptable now.
Yeah.
Now but it cool. wasn't. It wasn't for a long time. And I always embraced the mods that went through that period, and it was hard times. And I've chatted to Paul about it since, and he was sort of quite shocked that what we went through.
Right. The other thing with fanzines was the fact that every town kind of had one. So that when you talk about mod across the country and how it kind of seeds out, it's every, you know, it might only sell like 50, 100 copies, but every town had their version.
Great. It was great because it gave bands and musicians a voice that they weren't going to get interviewed by NME or Melody Maker or anything. So it was lovely that a fanzine could interview a local band and they get to say, well, that's why we're into it, you know. This is why we're playing this music. Mm. Nobody in the, you know, general culture were going to do it, so.
The other thing that gets off mentioned a lot and comes through in some of the imagery as well in the world of mod is dancing. Is that a thing? Is that for you? Is that because you don't see Wellard? He danced quite a bit in the Style Council, but there's not a lot of dancing going on in his career, right?
I don't want to say about Paul's. I don't know about Paul's dance. I've heard it's not great, but I don't know. I don't know. I always find I love dancing myself. I think I was quite a good dancer back in the day, but I don't know. I did notice that, I don't know if any of you lot noticed, but when you watch Solid Bond in Your Heart and Mick Talbot jump up at some, it looks so piss poor is the word I think we're looking for. Don't you find it? It's like, what are they doing? It's like, wouldn't you shoot that again? It's like,
yeah.
They're like, oh, it's all misjudged, isn't it? I don't know. So maybe I'm wrong.
I can't remember. There's one of the Style Council videos as well where Dean, it might have been Top of the Pops. Dean and Paul have got like a proper routine worked out. So you're like, they must have been practicing this at home in the front room. Brilliant. Their own music on the stereo. Wonderful. The other thing that comes through as well is the influence of jazz on the scene. And I guess
totally
this is so connected to the Style Council musically as well, right?
Yeah.
That was obviously something you were digging too.
Yeah, totally. I it was so weird because on the mod scene, all we'd ever heard jazz-wise was maybe a bit of Jimmy Smith, old organ jazz. And then there's all this talk about Absolute Beginners. So me and my mate Millet went to see Absolute Beginners at, I think it was the premiere in London. And I was so disappointed. I remember walking away thinking, God, is that it? Yeah, I'd read the book and I'm being so disappointed by, is this how we're seen? And obviously Weller didn't even get his Have You Ever Had It Blue. The whole record is
just a little snack.
Cut and it's so futile. And it's not very horrible. Yeah, David Bowie looks brilliant. He's amazing in it. But as a film, it just loses the plot. It's nothing to do with like the book. And we walked away from it. But at the same time, you had Paul Murphy and the jazz clubs were amazing at the time in the 80s. And that's where I went to. So as an alternative from the mod scene, there was Baz for Jazz and Giles Peterson. And there was some great jazz to be had out, and obviously that's what Paul was digging at the time as well. So it was a weird, it's a weird thing. Yeah, he yet again, I think it might have even been through him that I went that way. I don't know. I can't 100% say for sure, but probably, you know, I'd read Paul saying, you know, like jazz is the way or whatever. And that was it. Bang, I'm gone. And thinking, yeah, you're right. Yeah, wow.
Now, as you know, my discovery of Weller was solo. It was Aho, yeah, and then obviously we get Wild with Stanley Road. And to dig into the cover of Stanley Road in this book was fascinating for me because they actually rejected first versions. So it comes over from Peter Blake and they, no, it's not quite right. Like this absolute visionary creating this artwork. It's like, no, we need a couple of amends. But Paul was like, thought he'd be too expensive. And that was all came through Simon Halford.
Yeah.
But also didn't think that he was somebody you could approach to do an artwork for an album. You think about that album cover is so important to that LP, I think.
Yeah, that was the other amazing thing was during that is, so Peter Blake, wow. It was really weird because I think it might have been yet again through Mark Baxter. And Mark had done some work with Peter Blake. I was like, well, yeah, I really need to talk about Peter Blake for Mod Art. And I hadn't met him. And I like to meet my people I interview. So the one thing I always did was try and meet and people, whether it be Manchester or Birmingham, I'd get on the train and go off and interview them. Right? So it's always had to be real. I've got a weird thing. So when I wrote the, I don't do it now, I'll be honest.
Shortcut, right? Yeah.
But when I wrote my first book, I wrote everything out by hand. Everything.
The pen and paper.
Yeah. Everything had to be written out by hand. I've got the whole of the New Religion written out by hand. And then I edited what I wanted myself. And then obviously at that time, because I hadn't got a kid. And then when you get a child, you think, oh God, I haven't got the time. But when you got the time, you can write it properly. So I did everything. So by the time Mod Art came out, it was a bit half and half. It was, you know, trying to dig out what I could and write what I could. Everything I did, all that, the way through was try and write everything I could down that Peter told me. But then you realise that there's loads of stuff that people haven't bothered to tell you. And then you read up later and think, why didn't you tell me that? Why didn't you tell me that? There's a million things you could have told me. And they've told you the most obscure thing going.
So Peter Blake was the Mod target.
Oh, right? So what happened with Peter Blake was Mark Baxter said to me, I'm going to get you his number. So I rang up Peter Blake one day thinking that nobody would answer. And he went, okay, if you're in at 7:30 tonight, I'll answer all your questions. And I was like, yeah, I'll be there. And at 7:30, he rang me back and we were on the phone for an hour. And it was amazing that he went through everything. He went, are you happy with this? Are you happy with that? And I always remember asking about the Beatles cover. And he said to me, I'm sorry, Smiler. That's been covered so many times, you could look that up. But everything else, he was. And what was really weird was,
I can't be asked to tell the story again.
Yeah. And what was really weird was I got invited to the opening of the Jam exhibition, the first ever Jam exhibition at Somerset House. And he was there that night on the opening night. So Paul was there and Bruce was there and Peter Blake was there. It was the day after he'd given me the phone. So we never met. So I walked over to him and I went, I'm Smiler. I said, we did this. He went, oh, come on. And I sat with him for about half an hour. It was amazing. Wow. That I'm, you know, I never thought I'd get to sit with Peter Blake. And a bit later, I get up and Paul turned up with Bruce and he walked in. And I thought, and I actually, I think even then, I'm not even sure that Paul would recognize me. He went, all right, Smiler. He walked out. I'm like, my whole night, Peter Blake and Paul Weller. He went, all right, Smiler.
Job done.
Walked in. Yeah, I was so happy. Yeah, it's great.
You mentioned about the tail end of the 80s and the acid jazz movement and Eddie and all that. Obviously, Weller comes back beginning, well, around that time, right? So, you know, 1990, 91. And really embracing that scene. This must be a connection that you've talked to Paul about, surely, of the music of that time. And because he was really digging that, wasn't he?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it was his reemergence, really. I don't think he knew what path to take because there was all that horrible grunge stuff going on. And I think he just didn't, he could have been sunk. Paul Weller could have been sunk easily. His record label got rid of, Polydor didn't care about the Style Council anymore. And I think he could have been sunk, but I think because he's like, you know, he's a modernist. He's modernism is about taking the best of the past and the present and everything else, the best of it and most sus of it. And Paul knows that. And I think he saw what was going on with acid jazz and funk and the promotion of, yet again, another black culture. It's black culture moving forward. And Paul embraced it. And I think it was great. And what was great as well is he'd also realised that where he'd joined the Style Council, he'd sort of pretty much given up on the, I don't say given up on, but there was a moment where he didn't even want to play guitar. And so he starts listening to his old Small Faces and stuff. So it's a mixture of sort of Small Faces meets modern black culture. I think it's a brilliant album. Stanley Road is an amazing album. And I think the making of it really, and I remember we went to see him at Dublin Castle, which must have been like the really early, I think it might have been his first gig. And loads of people were moaning, why did you play jam stuff and jam stuff? There are a few of us going, wow.
So this was like Paul Weller Movement time.
Paul Weller Movement, yeah. Okay. So, I might be wrong. That would probably be, as far as I know, his first gig is Dingwalls at that time, which I think what year it was.
In 1990, end of 1990.
Yeah. So we went along to it as mods and we're like, I was like amazed at what he did. You know, like I thought, yeah, this is brilliant.
Also looked so sharp at that time. There's a Jonathan Ross TV appearance around that time, the one where he says about
bury me a mod.
Yeah. Which looks so cool, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, there's a little story of that because what happened was I'd sort of moved away. I'd always been in handmade shirts, handmade suits.
You weren't hand-making these, were you? Just check.
On the mod days, everything was about like tailor-made suits, tailor-made, yeah, everything was really sussed. You had to be proper sussed. And I moved away from that. I thought, oh, yeah, like when acid jazz came along. And I went out and bought my first pair of jeans for years. I wore jeans for years and years and years. I finally bought a pair of jeans. We were at Portobello Road. I was a mate called Nick Rowe, and we saw Paul Weller and DC Lee walking along looking really mod. I'm like, I want to say hello, but I've got jeans on. I couldn't say hello. And is that sad that I... Mate. He's like finally there, like, oh, I can't, no, I've got jeans on. We've got to walk away.
I love that. There must be like in the concert back in mind, what if you're getting dressed, what if this is the day where I bunk into Weller? I can't wear this. Tell me about, I mean, you've seen Paul Weller live solo so many times, and we could dig into the albums, the songs, all that stuff, but we haven't got time. But I do want to hear about Crystal Palace. Tell me about this gig. So this is 1997, A Day at the Races, yeah. And the lineup's incredible. I mean, Skunk and Nancy, Morcheeba, whatever happened to Morcheeba, Republica and Weller on the bill. Was it a Findy Quay gig? He used to turn up quite a lot, didn't he, to various things?
Maybe, yeah, I can't remember. What happened was, so by 97, there's a few of us, and we've sort of moved on from the mod scene. We're all, like, you know, wearing whatever we're wearing. We all call ourselves mods. To us, we're all mods, you know, like modernists. And by then, it could be Lacoste, Stone Island, or whatever. We're all wearing what we call clobber, you know, like wearing clobber, nice Paul Smith trousers, Patrick Cox loafers, you know, like proper money. Yeah. When you're working class boys and trying to look good. And so we're all off up to London. And I got there, me and my mate, Matty Ashman, and he's wearing like, you know, Lacoste and Adidas Gazelles or whatever. And we're going there and we meet a few other like-minded people and they're like, yeah, smiling. Yeah. We all feel like a part of a club. Yeah. It's like almost like outside the mod scene by then. We'd all been mods, but we're all like this part of like moving forward. And we're thinking, yeah, this is great. And we're seeing Weller and stuff. Really hot day. And we still haven't moved on from being absolute drinking nightmares. So we're all like, want a beer. Yeah, loads of us. So we're like, great, let's have a few drinks. Somehow I got lumbered with Smiling, you get the roundy. Yeah, like, I'll give you the money. And, yeah, whatever. So I'll get in the rounds. There's a beer tent and I go over to the beer tent and I said, look, whatever you do, make sure you're there. Just take the drinks off me because I'm getting by now at 12 pints or whatever. You make sure you're there. And I went, yeah, okay, yeah. As it goes on, I move it in and in and in, and there's more and more people behind me, and I can't see any of my friends, thinking, how the fuck am I going to get, you know, like 12 pints back to them or whatever? And then this girl says to me, she went, if I get served first, I'll get the drinks. And if you get served first, you get the drinks. I went, that's great. That's fine. End up, I get served. This woman went, you next. Right. What do you want? I went, I want 12 pints of lager. And I said to the girl, what would you like? She went, oh yeah, whatever she wants. And she gives me her money, like 20 quid. Okay, great. So I'm just getting served. I'm thinking, I'm still trying to look behind me, thinking, how am I going to get these drinks behind me? I went, have you got any tray? She went, no trays, they've all gone. I went, okay, I've got to get 12 pints back there. She went, I can get this. And she gets, what is, you know, when you get a packed of like lagers, you know, like you get the little 1-inch cardboard tray at the bottom.
Right, yeah.
Right. So what they flat pack a tray in. So she gives her that, and she goes, I'll put 6 pints in that. So she gives 6 pints in it. I'm looking at it thinking, how am I going to get that back there? And then one bloke goes, here, mate, I'll help you. I'll take one of them off you. And helps himself. And he's reached over. I went, mate, if you do that, you might as well take the fucking lot. Because it was quite a hot day. So it was quite hot. So I just threw the whole drinks over him. As any man should do who tries to steal the drinks. And he threw a punch at me. I ducked. He hit the bloke behind me.
Oh my God.
Who smacked him. And the whole place descended into chaos. I didn't get a punch on me. Next thing I know, the whole crowd's moved forward. I'm outside laughing my head off. Everyone's in the punch up and secure being called. And all my mates going, where's the drink swallow? Where's the drink swallow? I'm going, I don't know, mate. It doesn't matter now. And then the whole place collapsed. The whole tent collapsed. And a bit later, I walked past it and security going, where's them blokes who started it? Where's them blokes? And I ain't started it. But this woman went, I know you. You were involved in that fight, weren't you? I was like, was I? She went, yeah. Do you want your money back? And gave me my money back and the girl that gave me the 20 quid. So I was 20 quid up. So it all worked out. But my mate still says to this day, the great Crystal Palace Paul Weller beer riot, you started. And I'll take that.
Oh, my goodness me, love it. There's so much in this book. Another one that is absolutely fabulous. I have to recommend it. Mod art is brilliant. Right, we're going to skip on to your latest, which was actually a collaboration with Baxter. We talked about with Baxter.
Bax.
With Mark. Called Scorcher. This was an idea from Mr. Go on, have a glug of beer. This was, don't cause a riot. This was an idea of Paul Weller's, right?
Yeah.
How did that come about? That's amazing.
It's from the first time I ever met Paul, really. We got chatting and Paul went, as he does, goes, I love Smiler, I love your book. Yeah, no, I love it. Blah, blah, blah. And when
is that an impression of Paul or Bax?
Yes, okay, Paul, right. Paul, that was Paul. Sorry, yeah. No, he's like, that's Bax. Yeah. Paul said, no, if you do that, he said, oh, you've done a good job on that job mod. You've got to do one on like Suede's. I was thinking, oh God, you know, like it's so small. It's such a small part. And Omnibus will never agree to that. As much as I was in with them.
Small part meaning length of period of time.
Yeah, yeah. History, right? So, yeah, such a small period of time and such a little thing that most people wouldn't have no idea what a suede. Most people know what a skinhead is.
Yeah.
People with suede, no. So I went to Omnibus about it and I said, oh, you know, like Paul's been saying about doing a follow-up about suedes. They're like, shut up. Yeah. And I said, well, what about if I go – people know about skinheads. Well, I knew skinheads and suedes. And straight away, they were like, oh, you know, like skinheads, right wing. So, no. Original skinheads, reggae loving, clothes loving, nothing to do with right wing. And I'll make a point of it. And I said to them, you know, like if there was a point when skinheads would think that I'm B being the most anti-skinner person and they want to beat the you know what out of me, then I'll do it. And they went, okay, then that's fine. I said, it would be a real point of it having to be non-right wing. And that's how we got it. And so I approached back about it and said, look, I've now got a little boy, because when I wrote The New Religion, I didn't have a little boy, and realised that how much my time, because I've got a full-time job as well. And I said, I haven't got enough time to do a whole book on my own these days. And I knew that Bax would be ideal to do it with. So he went, yep, all right, I'll do it, son, as he does. And he went off and did it. And he was brilliant. He got me stuff. I mean, I wrote that book. I wrote all that book, basically. Bax got me contacts, photographs, everything.
Yeah,
yeah. Bax has been a brilliant person to do it with. And what was mental as well, which was the other thing, was I was doing mod art. When I was doing mod art, I went with David Barraclough to a photo library. So these photo library places that you can go to, these places that own all these photographs, and it was completely out the window. And what happened was I'd already got mods out, the Mods of New Religion, and they said, oh, yeah, you've got to do another book, yeah, mod art. So I was doing mod art. So I was doing mod art, and he went, do you want to go to a photo library place? I went, yeah, okay. And in that meantime, I met Weller. When Weller had gone, oh, you've got to do, yeah, like, you've got to do this book about, like, suede heads and stuff. I went, great. So we went to this big place. It's called Time Inc., I think. It's called Time Inc. And they had everything from TV Times and Melody Maker and then all the photo library. Wow, I could look for everything I ever wanted to. And they brought this stuff that they thought that I might like. And they brought these pictures out. And they were so minuscule, you had to look for them through a magnifier. And I said, what are they? And they went, oh, it's nothing. We brought them down by accident. I said, well, what are they? He went, no, it's accident. Don't even look at it. And curiosity got the better of me. I went, oh, can I look at them? So I looked at them, and they were colour photographs taken of suede heads in 1970 from TV Times. And they're in that book, and that's the only time they've ever been put. And I was like, wow! Like, they went, what? I went, that's for my next book. Not my art, the next book. Yeah, like, I'd already been thinking ahead. And that's what appears in there. It was totally fluke.
Love it.
They've appeared in there. And they're the only full-colour pictures that have ever appeared of skinheads and suede heads that haven't been seen.
Paul was featured in the book. What really comes through is his absolute love of that period, because he was a kid. Yeah. So he talks about as being 12, I think, in 1970. Brings back so many, you know, famously somebody who doesn't look back and all that. But he clearly doesn't mind talking about this stuff.
No. Him and Mick Talbot were both brilliant in that. It's a weird thing because you can chat to Paul and he's not very, he doesn't talk about the past and stuff. If you talk to him about, he just doesn't care about it. It's really weird. It's a really, totally unlike me. I'm complete opposite, but he will dismiss it and go, no, whatever. But there is a period that you can talk to him about, and it is really, you know, Of all periods, it's his suede, young suede period, and he will open up totally and chat about it. And I think he really loved, and he was so desperate for me to bring out that book. That's definitely his period that he loves.
Yeah, because it's also like you get the impression it's pre-Jam, it's pre him being a, for want of a better expression, a star, if you like. He's just the love of being a kid. Having no weight on your shoulder, no pressure or whatever. Him and his mates, but still loving fashion. The love of fashion at such a young age really comes through. So I'll read you a little bit from it. He was talking about, where is it? I was 12 in 1970. That's when I seriously got into clothes. My mum bought me my first pair of Levi's, maybe 501s, but they had a zip fly at the co-op for 30 bob, £1.50. With them and my Brutus, I felt I was in. Brutus being checked shirt, was that right?
Yeah.
But 12 years old and totally already... Bang, I love the strides, I love the fashion, I love the look.
Yeah.
Yeah, and all that. And the thing that comes through as well is when you see him, like I saw, we played in the exhibition in Brighton, a little clip of Mick and Paul talking about the Style Council. Some of those memories are hazy, can't remember the records or where they were recorded or how he wrote them or whatever. But that period of time is absolutely crystal clear. The amount of detail he's giving you about things is remarkable.
And he's always like that. He would always say, Now, oh, have you seen this picture of me? And he's wearing a pair of, you know, like loafers. And even now, he'll ping it over and go, proper suaded days or whatever. So he'll ping it over now. And he's definitely got a love for it. There's no denying that at all. It's that period is his love.
Yeah, that's really interesting, I have to say. Hey, look, we're running out of time. I do have some more questions that we're going to have to cram in before we go. All right. These books, to me, I mean, I know I don't want to add another job onto your workload, right? But there's a podcast in these stories, you know, because these are captured as almost like pieces of audio where you have snippets from each individual.
Yeah.
You know, Eddie does the Modcast. Would you ever be interested in doing this kind of thing, this kind of world, interviewing people about this passion of yours?
I would, but I just haven't got the bloody time, in truth. I'm a postman. I work 40 years as a postman. I'm a writer. I'm a DJ. And I try and fit everything else in. And I've got, sadly, my son's got ADHD. So I spend a lot of time with my son and trying to sort things out. So it's a world, isn't it? It's real life. It's trying to sort things out. Yeah, my wife does more for my son than I ever could. But, yeah, I try and do what I can. But no, it's a bloody full-on life, to be honest. So, yeah, I'd love not to have my post office life and have, yeah, and make enough money that I could easily just write and everything, but I can't, so. Yeah.
Eddie and I talked about the Modcast, and, I mean, that's an incredible podcast that's become live events, weekend events. You know, it was kind of the inspiration for these type of things, but he's taken it to, you know, Mallorca and the Brighton Beanies, all this stuff is incredible how he's kind of developed that, and you've been a key part of that all the way through those.
DJ, yeah.
But one thing I did ask Eddie was how you get on those. Do you have to prove that you're a mod, and if so, is there a mod test? I'll ask the same question to you. No. And is mod something you can just take up at any point? Could I decide tomorrow that I want to be a mod? And if so, how would I start? See, I've got too many questions.
That's a brilliant question. That is a brilliant question. I tell you what, the first is the reason I'm involved in the Modcast is because it's so anti the retro world that I was involved in. So, I was involved in the 80s, a heavily retro world where it was all to tailor-made clobber and handmade shirts and original labels and stuff. So I was very involved in that to the point where I named the Untouchables rallies and stuff. I was very heavily involved in that. But the minute Acid Jazz Now turned up, I walked away from it. Mods and modernism are two different things. Even though I call myself a mod, modernism is about moving forward. And that's why Paul, when he spoke to me, was very interested that I had that view. He wouldn't be interested if I was like, oh, I know it's about 1963 and we only lift that label and that. He wouldn't be interested in that at all. Paul is very much, and I'd realised that that's what it's about. It's about modernism. It's about adopting stuff, whether it be what the casuals were doing or jazz funk or hip-hop or whatever. You have to have a bit of knowledge about everything and take on board what is going on. That's what I'd done at that time without knowing Paul. This is back in the 90s. So the reason I'm involved in the Modcast is because the Modcast is very welcoming and anyone go on a Modcast event, so you can hear anything there. I've played Paul Weller and Jam stuff and the Style Catch gets played. It's always like definite. Yeah, like that's always like the law. So we play that all the time. So you'd never get away without hearing either the Jam, the Style Council, ever, or Weller. You could never get away from a Modcast event without Weller having some influence on it. But at the same time, it might have hip-hop, or it might have rap, or it might have 70s soul, or whatever. It will always move forward, but it's about moving forward. The second part of your thing, you can only be a mod if you've got attention to detail, in my opinion. So you can go through it stumbling and going, this is what I want to do. I'll wear that. But there's no reason why you couldn't now, with all the, you know, the internet and that, move forward of having your own look. I don't want anyone to think that, oh, whatever I wore today, I'm all a park with badges. I haven't worn a boat in blazer. I haven't worn, I don't wear anything. I wear my own style. And I think that people should be able to embrace their own stuff. Yeah, have their own imprint on it. So it's not about wearing what everybody thinks you should do. So
like that.
Anyone could be a mod. Yeah.
I like that. My copy of Detail magazine came through the post the other day. which is a fabulous publication. And it came through. My wife brought it from the front door, and she went, "Oh, for fuck's sake, you're not a mod now as well, are you?" Which did make me chuckle. The modcast, you got to feature with Weller on an episode with Eddie in the studio.
Two episodes.
And it was really funny because you and Eddie just wanted to talk to Paul about the Jam, the Style Council.
I didn't. No, I know. Eddie wanted to talk to
me. Oh, okay. So Eddie's just standing there. Right, yeah. And then all Paul wants to do is hear your stories.
Yeah.
All you want to do is hear Paul. So it's like the three of you. Like.
It was lovely. That was such a moment. So what happened was we all go out. Eddie has said to me, because I don't know if I should say this, but so Eddie and Paul's relationship had been a bit fractured. So Eddie said to me, "Smiler, can you sort this out? Yeah, I'd love to get him on the podcast." So I'm the sort of go-between man. I went, Eddie's a good guy. He's got his heart right. So I had to do all the thing. Anyway, it's all sorted. We get it done. So we're all meeting up in a restaurant in Soho, and Paul's just asking all the questions before we go in. Yeah, he wants to know, like, an hour before, where do we land? Yeah, where do we lie? And that. It's all fine. So we get in the studio, and it was lovely that the fact that Eddie suddenly descends into this whole thing of how did the Jam do this? And I could see Paul was getting fed up because Paul doesn't like being asked about all the questions he's been asked for.
They were proper geeky Jam questions, to be fair.
Yeah, they were. But it was like I could see that Paul was getting like the hump a little bit. Because I don't know if you know, it's in two parts. If you get to listen to it, the second part is so much better. It's in two parts. So the first part, I think Paul's getting a bit of the hump, like, oh, same old questions about the Jam and that, getting a bit fed up about it. And he went, "Oh, saw this. Smiler, let's talk about your book." I was like, wow, that is brilliant. So we start talking about my book.
I'd rather hear about that.
Yeah. So that was lovely. But the second part was great because I think we'd, in that period, because we were there for, a few hours chatting, I think he'd relaxed a bit more and it wasn't about the Jam anymore and about mods and stuff. And he was quite happy. They'd just chat about. So the second, I always say part two flourishes a little bit, like how he feels. But it was lovely. I've never forgotten that. And there's a great moment that which says about Paul's sense of humor. There's a bit where we interviewed him and my phone goes off and Paul Weller goes, "Who's that smiling? Your mum." So that's typical Paul.
And it was. Two final questions for you before you go. You're allowed one Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. It can be the Jam, the Style Council, or solo. What are you going to go with?
Bloody hell. God. If it was the Jam, it would always be Life from a Window.
Okay. If it was the Style Council?
Big Boss Groove.
Oh, okay. And if it was the solo?
I'm very political, by the way.
We didn't even get into that. Yeah. Solo?
Solo. No, Above the Clouds.
Okay. And if you were to put your earpods in straight after this as you walk off into the sunset, what would be the first one? What would be the tune you'd put on?
What, by Paul Weller?
Yeah. I assume you'd put that on. Yeah. Not by anybody. Yeah. By
okay.
Where?
Change Your Man.
Oh. Nice. Oh, got some happy people in the audience. Tune, man. Tune. Yeah, well done.
Because do you know why? That was a really important thing because when we were moving away from the mod thing, all the things, Change Your Man, Here's a New Thing, were all pointers to move on. To me, it was, that meant everything to me. Here's a New Thing, especially, was like, move on.
Final question. Purpose of this podcast is to talk to people like you and these amazing books. Honestly, if you haven't dug into these yet, you really should do. Incredible amounts of work, but really fascinating pictures of our history, captured in these publications. So yes, it is about that. And I do love talking to people like yourself, but the purpose of this event, this purpose of this podcast is to get the interview with Paul Weller. And I've realized I need to speak to you and I need to speak to Bax to make this happen, obviously. But if it happens, when it happens, what should I ask him?
He would never want to know about the old days. You're better off asking him, what's the latest band you've heard that you like? He's very much future, very less retro, and always looking forward. So prop modernist.
Sound advice. What a lovely way to end. Hey, please give it up for my very special guest, Paul Smiler Anderson.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.